maybe I will start with John's comment to Matthew. Okay. He said, we know that John's part of the group, and John doesn't particularly like to read books that don't have dialectic in them. So he looked at your book and went, oh. And he said, I didn't think I'd like it. And he says, I'm loving it. And he says, I'm taking it tonight, and I think he's going to his daughter's practice or something like that. And while she practices, he's going to finish the book. And he says, I'm near the end, and I have no idea how it's going to end. Mm-hmm. And I like that.
Well, probably at the point where he's at, I didn't either.
So he said that he was not only surprised by the book, because he didn't think he'd like it, but that he has been captivated by it all along. So I just pass that on.
Yeah, that's very kind.
Yeah. I'm curious now, what was your inspiration?
Well, it's an interesting story. This goes back to a story I read in Camus Chronicles about James Bay. And back in the 1870s, there was a ship that came up from San Francisco. Smallpox broke out, and they quarantined it. And there was this house that some guy started building right at the bottom of Government Street by the water. And he'd left it there, and they used that, the remains of that house, as a quarantine house for the few people that had smallpox. And actually, there's still a stone. If you walk one of the paths to the right of all those poplars, there's a stone for Bertha Whitney.
Oh, yeah.
5 years old. She was one of the children on that ship. Anyway, so it was used as, they called it a pest house, and then it sat for a long time. Then this guy named Angel, there's not a record of his first name, came up. He was looking for a place to buy or to build, because he said he was bringing his wife up from California, so he found this place. He started working on it. There's an episode where someone saw him one day talking to this tall woman who no one had seen since before that time and since that time. I just saw this, and they were having this heated kind of argument. It's the only time anyone ever saw her. 2 weeks later, this guy is murdered at where he's building the cottage. And they found the people who did it. But I thought, you know, I wonder who these people were. And I'd like to write a story that tells about who these two people were and how they came to be at this particular place here in James Bay in the 1870s. So I thought, okay, I'll start by tracing the life of the woman from when she's a young girl, and then I'll trace the life of the guy and how they meet. So she was going to be, you know, from southern Ontario. He was going to be from the States. They would somehow meet during the Civil War and fall apart again and then meet again here. And that was going to be the book. That's how it started out. And, you know, 300 pages later, I'm still in 1856, a year and a half, and okay. Well, I knew well before that that it was just going to be about Gretchen. And because I guess I knew about 100 or 125 pages in that it was just going to be about her, and I wasn't going to get anywhere near where the plan was. And so, but that's interesting itself, because I never... when I write a story, I never know where it's going to go from one sentence to the next. And I really like that, so that as I'm writing, it's almost like reading it at the same, you know, like reading someone else's book, right, except you're writing it. And so I never know where things are going to go. And I should have understood that to have a plan like that was ridiculous, and to bring it up to the 1870s. So that was the inspiration for starting that story. And then I got to like Gretchen a lot.
What I was amazed about was the insight you showed about Gretchen at her age, meaning being 15, and then her sisters, and the fact that that's a tremendous amount of insight. Or maybe you modeled her after someone that you knew, or
you had daughters
yourself that you've really got close to their growing up time and.
I don't have kids. I don't know. I didn't set out with the idea that this would be a first person narrative, and I don't know how it started that way. It just did. This whole novel came with the first line. I got the first line was God's fire, and I just really liked that line, and so it went from there. And then I don't think I knew at the beginning that it was going to be a single first-person narrative all the way through. And the first novel I wrote, which still hasn't been published yet, is a series of first-person narratives. But this book did get turned down by a couple of publishers. And I remember one letter basically saying, in as polite a fashion as the woman could, like, how dare you think you can write as first-person narrative as a 16-year-old girl?
How dare they respond that way?
Yeah. Well, it's not the only person who's had that criticism. This thing called appropriation of voice. But then, if you can't put yourself into someone else's skin, you can't be a writer. You can't always write as yourself or just as a male or a male of a certain age. Mm-hmm. And so, so I don't know why it worked. It just felt comfortable.
Actually, what I tried to do was, after I read it, I said, what if Gresham was male? And maybe it was really not about gender, maybe it was just about the whole process of growing up. First of all, in the 1850s, that time period, or just the fact that it's just a natural thing for, no matter who it is, whether you're a male or a female, it really doesn't make any difference, but some of you, it could have been just that awareness, that awakening about themselves.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because I think there's something about coming of age that does cut across gender lines, and there are a lot of parts of it that don't. But I guess, for me, that it was the coming of age part of it that really intrigued me the most, because that such an important time in anyone's life. It certainly was in mine. And it's a time of great, everything's possible. And then once you pass through that period, a lot of things don't become possible anymore. I think part of it was to, writing it was to just remember that sense of possibility again and just revel in it for a while. But I did have some good women friends of mine read the drafts just to make sure it rang true, that I wasn't saying something that was just like, oh yeah, that's a guy writing as a girl. So.
Yeah, I certainly couldn't have told whether it was written by a man or a woman. If somebody said, well, just make a guess, I'd say, well, probably a woman, because there's such insight into this young woman, or a guy with young daughters, so it's incredible that did that so nicely.
Yeah, because when we were reading it, we were commenting on, how you being a man could sort of get into a young girl's head like that.
Whenever anyone says that, I just take that as a very wonderful compliment. I don't know how to explain.
You did a lovely job with all three of the girls.
Yeah, not just
especially the little one. Perfect.
Yeah.
Just perfect.
Yeah, it's several people have mentioned that's their favorite character in the book.
And Sally, doing it all through her violin, and the depth of her use of the violin, the message she tried so hard to impart, and often I think did, through her playing.
Yeah, I had no idea that she was going to be silent when I first got to her, and then I can't remember where the dream came, because it starts with that dream of the heron.
The heron?
Mm-hmm. And and then I just thought, well, that's pretty neat. It's different. But it wasn't a plan.
And I'm interested in the fact that the father then becomes mute in the way that he does. I'm wondering what you can parallel from your own background about two so pivotal characters in the story living that way.
Yeah. Well, the father becoming silent, and again, I just go back and I said that I never know what's happening from one sentence to the next, one page to the next. So I didn't know, once I had Sally as a character who was silent, I didn't know that the father was, this was going to happen to the father, he was going to be silent. So it wasn't, I was thinking, oh, wouldn't this be an interesting parallel in the story? It just happened.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, this works. I don't even think I thought about, as I was writing the book, the parallel between the two. After it was done, I thought, oh, this is interesting. But in terms of my own experience, I had a silent father. Mm-hmm. You know, we just didn't speak for the entire time I was growing up. So silent fathers, and you know, that kind of rigidity was familiar to me. Mm-hmm. So that. But again, I didn't consciously write him from my experience with my father. I'm sure it was there unconsciously, but I didn't do it consciously. I didn't say, oh, you know, I know this, therefore I can write this. And Sally's silence, again, I can see unconscious connections, you know, I mean, given, you know, having a silent father, therefore, to a great extent, I was a silent child, necessarily, in that relationship. But again, Sally was not, I didn't in any way consciously compose her after myself. It's just, but you know, those things are going to come up. You can't, they obviously will come up. And I think that, I think all writers will have parts of themselves in their books that they don't intend to put there, but you cannot help putting there. Because you necessarily write from who you are, from where you are, from how you are. You can't escape that. I mean, you can. No, you can't escape it completely in the end. That's my sense.
I would imagine, too, that the way that you described your process when you write, just not knowing yourself what's coming is coming from that unconscious place in you a lot of the time.
I mean,
those places live inside you, but you may not be thinking them through or even noticing them.
Yeah. No, I think you're right about that. And because people often ask, you know, where does it come from? I mean, all writers get asked that question. Where does that image come from? Where do these ideas come from? And they come from those unconscious places. And that's as much as I want to know. Like, I don't want to analyze it any further than that. I know writers who speak about that, who address exactly where all this stuff comes from. For me, there's a mystery involved, you know, if it's like channeling a voice or where these ideas come from. I don't want to know because I'm afraid that if I do know, it'll paralyze me and I won't be able to write. It reminds me of. I was raised Catholic, and in the early 1960s, the Vatican II, I think it was 1962, up until that time, the Catholic Mass was said in Latin, always in Latin, and then they decided, Vatican II, that the Mass would be said in the language of whatever the parish was. And I remember that many of the elders in churches all around the world, really resented that and stopped going to church, and the reason was they missed the mystery of the Latin. They didn't want to know what all the words meant. They didn't want to know it all because it was the mystery that attracted them. And you take away the mystery, the attraction is gone. And it's that same kind of thing, I think, with me and where the ideas come from. It's a mystery.
When you're writing in that place of mystery, and when a character pops up or when a character changes in whatever way, How are you experiencing all this? What's it like to what's the experience like to write like that in that mystery?
I don't really know how to answer that. I'm trying to think of, go back and just think what it feels like as I'm writing.
Yeah.
That's where any of the stuff I write. And I think the best I can say is that it again has to do with that idea of mystery, that it allows me to go to a place that's outside my everyday life, that is, more inviting, more possible. It's a place where I can, I guess to say, make things happen. I want to come back and qualify that in a minute. Make things happen that aren't happening in my life, or that can't, or don't seem that they can happen. And so you become other people. And by becoming other people, you therefore have different possibilities than the ones you have in your own life. And you can explore those. I think that's really attractive.
Oh, it sounds delicious.
But
you have to get your writing penny, and then you can get right into the computer.
But the thing I want to qualify about where you can make things happen, I remember working on my first novel, and again, I had a bit of a plan. I had an idea where the characters were going to go, and I soon realized that because I had created them, or they had presented themselves to me in the way that they did, or the way that I created them, they weren't going to go where I had planned. And I know I've heard other writers say this, and I remember hearing other writers say this before I ever tried to write a novel. And then they would say, well, I created these characters, and I just had to follow where they were going to go. And I thought, oh, that's just so precious. And then when I started writing, I found it really is true. They do. I mean, I start off, the only thing I start off with is say, what if I had these people in this place at this particular time? That's what I've got. So I've got these characters in that place and that time. Let's see what will happen. And once you start writing the characters, they very quickly start writing themselves. And it still sounds precious, I know, when I say it, but it really does happen, at least for me. Mm-hmm. And so they become their own people, and you can't make them do stuff they don't want to do that wouldn't make sense for them to do.
It's that authenticity that comes through them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because I have had moments where I've written characters where I knew that I was really directing the character, and it doesn't work. It
doesn't ring true.
It doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, it must be really exciting for you. It's like reading a book as you're going along.
Well, it is, because you get to write the book that you would like to read that no one else has written yet. So just do it yourself.
Editing do you do? These kind of present themselves, and that, do you ever come across something that's not working and you have to go back?
Well, you know, my editing process has changed recently, but the first novel and this one, which is the second one I wrote, I would write a sentence or two, and if the sentence didn't feel right, I would change it right at that time. But once I wrote the whole book, that was pretty much it. I know a lot of writers who do drafts, they do several drafts of the novel. For me, when that first draft was done, it was the novel. And I made some really minor changes to it. And then when you get, the publisher sets you up with their editor, and so Harriet Richardson, who's the editor, she made some suggestions, but they were all, they're all pretty minor changes to do with change the tense here or something. There was only one thing that she maybe changed it, actually add that it wasn't in the book. And it was a reason for Gretchen's father hanging himself. Mm. I didn't have that in there. There's no reason for it. Mm. And so I went back, and that's when Gretchen finds the note, mm-hmm. The little drawing of two stars. Mm-hmm. So that was the explanation. And it, again, it was just very brief, and I didn't want it any more than that. I wanted it to remain a little bit mysterious. But so in terms of get back to editing, no, I just, I thought, this is great. This is where I'll always write. It'll be wonderful. And I've worked on stuff since then. I can't seem to write like that anymore. And I think, it's because, well, I know what's missing. I happen to teach English literature at the university. And, you know, the way we do it, you know, you analyze stories, you analyze everything. And the more I do that with other people's stories, it starts to become part of my process, and I hate that. There are a lot of reasons I'd like to stop teaching. I love the teaching process, but a lot of reasons I'd like to stop, and that's one of them, so that I can stop doing that.
Like an inner critic forms.
And then again, maybe it's something that happens, like, you know, the first couple of things you write, there's this kind of natural fluidity, and then it can't last. I mean, it might just be that. I don't know. Mm. But.
Are you writing a novel now?
Yeah. I wrote one before that, which is how I got my agent, and she's a great agent, and the novel before this, and I still think is a better novel. I like this one. But the first one I really like, my agent loves it. She's been trying to sell it for years. I've had well-known and often published writers that I know read it. They can't understand why it's not getting picked up. This is another whole story maybe we'll talk about later. But so I have that one and this one that I wrote. Another one... And I didn't like it, and so I've taken it back, and now I've started the one I'm working on now. And here's another thing that happened. That book is, as the first one, I think has a lyrical quality to the writing. And for me, the style and the lyricism is as important as the content for me as a writer. It's just... what has happened, actually the novel I wrote after that, which was another very lyrical novel, the comments we got back from all the publishers were, they would all say, wonderfully written, beautifully written, but not enough tension.
Tension?
Not enough tension. They want tension. And
Dan Brown.
The tension, yeah. Dan Brown. Yeah, I wouldn't mind having a book that sells like his, but... So I realized that for whatever reason, the kind of stuff I really like to write is not what the publishers want. And I thought, okay, do I want to try to write something that has tension, consciously put tension so that it will get published? Or do I just write what I like to write, and if it never gets published, so be it. So then I thought, what if I can do both those things at once? So the novel I'm working on now, it's a first person narrative, a guy, he's about 60, he teaches English in a university. And so he decides to, let me just emphasize that that's where the similarity ends, because this next part is not autobiographical. He decides that the only way you can get a novel published is not to have anything to do with the content, but how he writes it. So he decides to kidnap this young woman, change her up in his basement, and says basically, here's the thing. And he's got a gun. He says, you're going to tell me a story, and I'm going to write this story. And once I'm done, I'm either going to shoot you or I'm going to shoot myself. But in either case, this book will get published because of how it got written.
And
so, this is his story. So now that part of the story, the frame story, will be the tension.
Yeah.
But
a little bit.
So as she's telling him the story, he writes this novel. In the novel, and that's the novel I would write. That's the lyrical.
Clever.
So I don't know if this will work. It's almost done. So we'll see. So there's a lot of tension going between the guy and this woman, obviously.
How old's the woman?
She's in her mid-20s. He sees her in a cafe, and she's writing in her journal. She's by herself, and he's thinking.
Did she look like Gretchen at all?
No, but you know what? There's at some point, he's writing, you know, about his first-person narrative, the part of the book. And he's talking about how he fantasizes about women, and he often fantasizes about women, you know, from novels. And he pick a couple of heroines from Thomas Hardy and from Richard Brodick, and he mentions their names. And I just put these down, like Vida. I don't say the books, but I mention Gretchen Williamson. So if this thing does get published,
people madly go off to Google and go, Gretchen Williamson.
A crass way to get people to buy my other books.
I mean, I'm not sure, but is there sort of a trendiness to books, popularity of books?
I don't know. I think there is, and I would readily admit that I'm not really up on, I don't analyze what it is that people are really looking for, and maybe I should, but no, I shouldn't. Yeah, it's there are trends, and I've decided that, I mean, other than this little thing I'm doing with attention,
right. But
not selling myself out altogether with the book I'm writing now, I've really decided that I need to write what I like and what I think is a good book, and if it gets published, that would be great. If it, you know, sells a lot, that would be great. If it doesn't get published, then it doesn't get published. But I won't stop writing because stuff doesn't get published.
Right.
It's you know, I hope it does, but I just wish I was one of those people that love to write the stuff that people love to buy, that publishers love to publish, but I don't.
I couldn't understand why this book wasn't better known.
It's
because of the tension, yes.
No, it's not that, because it didn't get published, but Thistledown Press, I met with them when they decided to take the book and from Saskatoon. They came and met with me here, and we talked about it, and they, you know, raved a lot about it. But it's a small press. They put absolutely no promotion behind this thing. Nothing. They said they didn't have money for book tours or anything like that. And so that's. And I didn't. Couldn't afford to do it myself.
Yeah.
So that's.
What about the situation, though? Is there a recent book that won, what was it, the Booker Prize or something? And they had to go out and find a bigger publisher because it's published by a really small publisher.
Yeah, I know. It's these things are hit and miss, really. I think
sure.
It's, you know, if the right person had read this and championed it, maybe it could have been great. And I don't know. And there are books out there that do get championed and do so well, and I read and I think, really? You know, and so when you think about it, when you send the manuscript out, there are one or two or three people who read it, and they decide if they like it or not. And so when you think, okay, my manuscript's been turned down by such and such a publisher. It's been turned down by so-and-so who didn't happen to like it, didn't think it was publishable. And I just try to keep that in mind, that there's a lot of luck involved. And you can try to go out and consciously try to make that luck happen, but I'm pretty clear that I'm not changing how I write. So.
Well, I don't know how anybody else feels, but we've read a lot of books in this mm-hmm. book group. This is by far one of the best, as far as I'm concerned.
It's awesome.
The best we've ever read.
Well, I think one of the things that I had just finished before I read your book, I had just finished Judge Boyden's Through Black Spruce, which might have put me in the sort of frame of mind, so when I started reading your book, it just kind of flowed right into it. So the character, Mbeki Tiwa, there was an interest point for me for saying, well, what's more behind this character? And then, you know, but at the same time, at the end, I said, well, you know, that's probably, when I think back in my life, when I was growing up, you know, people would pop into in and out of my life, and I didn't have put a lot of weight on their influence, but that's the way it really is. And yeah, at that time, you know, he had that kind of influence on Gretchen.
Yeah, I think she's really lucky to meet him. Mm-hmm. She's lucky to be born in that time, in that place. His name, Mbeki Tiwa, I thought, you know, I'll just go and find an actual name of an Ojibwe Indian at all time. But no, I don't do that. So I researched the Ojibwe language and came up and constructed that name, which means, you know, with Two Rivers. So that's how I got his name. But he talks about his father, Kanubine, who was an actual person from that time. Mm. A lot of the events that happened there actually happened. So, and all this, the street names and everything are real. And that's where I grew up. Mm-hmm. And that's another thing about actually writing the novel is all the novels that I've worked on are all set in that place at different times. The first novel I wrote was from the 1950s to the 70s in the same place. Because the marsh, I grew up by the marsh, and that place had such a powerful effect on you know, it's made whoever I am, it's because of growing up in that place. And so part of the reason for, you know, when I had the original plan of these two characters, part of the reason for having her come from this place is because it's my place, and it's a way of preserving it for me. And even the novel I wrote that's set in the 50s and 60s and 70s, that place no longer exists. It's changed so much, that whole area. And so it's the place that really attracts me to.
The story of what happened to his father, convincing them that he was impervious to this.
That's a true story. That's a true story. Yeah, I don't think I could make something up like that. That's
so true. Astonishing.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
I was interested in it seemed to me that there was a parallel between the stone that in her pocket, the stones, and her father's heart, which was quite stone-like. And as I was doing a little bit of researching around that, I came up with an interesting quote from Ezekiel. And it says, "I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit in you. I will remove from you your heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh." And it seemed to me that Gretchen carried the stone in the form of the rocks, but her heart had this really vibrant spirit, and yet and it was sort of reversed in her father, that his heart was quite stone-like in how he treated his Gretchen, at least, and I found that a really interesting kind of juxtaposition of flesh and stone.
That's great. I love that. I had no idea. I would never have thought about that. I love when that happens. When people find connections that I had no idea were there. Well, that makes perfect sense. I really like that.
Do you have a sense of what took you to Ireland, to the corpse and the peat bog, and that huge draw for Patrick? I imagine you've been to Ireland.
Yes.
Yeah. Seen the PS. I thought you probably had.
Connemara, Clifton. Connemara. Yeah, that's why I had it.
Right.
There.
Felt surreal, yeah.
Yeah, I don't write about places I haven't been.
No.
I don't know in some way. I'm not attracted. So, yeah, and so that's why the whole thing about the buried man, I have no idea where that came from.
Mm.
Or
intriguing.
But where he came from.
Mm.
Yeah.
And they have found buried bodies.
Yeah, and I think I was probably reading something about that at the time. Mm-hmm. It was somewhere else in Europe where they found this.
It was north of England.
Was it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, very
so
well preserved.
That, mm-hmm. Yeah, that
and
was
you
probably.
You can touch their eyeballs.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it is exactly as you described it in the book. I mean, National Geographic reports that anyway.
I remember reading about that, and that must be why I that came up. Because
yeah.
I was familiar with that idea.
Something about the acidic content of the peat bog helped
yeah.
to preserve in
yeah.
some way.
Yeah.
Cans. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I like the Patrick going back to his bog and her with
yes.
her.
Yes.
You know, the water in both places
yeah.
was a connection, I thought, too.
Mm-hmm.
That it, in a way, it was the water that drew him back as much as, I mean, the water as it, you know, in relation to the body, and as much as it was important in her life and growth.
Mm-hmm.
See now that?
And the stones, both of them, too.
I wasn't aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
But it makes sense. And you know, this will sound really ridiculous, but this is such an obvious connection between the peat bog and the marsh.
Yeah.
I never thought about that till now, until you mentioned that.
And he was a stone hooker. So they had the
stones.
Yeah.
And the stone, what is a stone hooker? I never quite...
I don't know if I explained that well enough in the story, but yeah, in Portrait, there was that scene where she sees him with the long poles. All of the lake bottom around the mouth of the Credit River is covered in this, it's called Dundas Shale. And there were these boats, stone hookers. They would go and they have the scows behind, as I described, and they would have these long poles with forks on them. And these guys would just, you know, lower the poles in, grab on, hook onto a hunk of stone, and these would be big pieces of stone, and haul them up and put them on the scow. And so that's hooking stone hookers, that's where it comes from. And a lot of that stone was used, the original paving stones for the main roads in that area.
Were they doing it blindly? They
couldn't
see what they were doing?
They would be able to see because it was not that deep where they were, and you could see, and this is the other thing, I remember when I was a kid growing up there in the Credit River, I remember going out fishing, you know, I was 6 or 7, and going in a rowboat on the river. And the water was absolutely clear. You could see right to the bottom. You could see everything. And in the lake, you could see the bottom. It's perfectly clear. Now, it's just brown. It's just brown. You cannot see a millimeter below the surface.
Wow.
And the lake is the same. But at that time, so even as a kid, it was clear. And at that time, it was just, you could see what you're doing.
I'm not surprised in some ways to hear that you didn't initially have an explanation for the father suiciding, hanging himself. Because I noticed a couple of things. Like you set up the situation between Gretchen and her mother fairly near the end, where Gretchen's going to read Walt Whitman, but doesn't.
Right.
Chickens out, and that was one incident. There was at least one other, where it was kind of like it's building this tension. I, as the reader, was expecting it to go somewhere that would give some kind of resolution to this situation. situation, but you don't. And realize that by not doing so, I mean, there is tension there.
Yeah, there is. But the kind of tension Bob is looking for is really obvious,
Hollywood.
Unsubtle
yes.
tension.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, there is.
A chopped off hand pointing to the ceiling.
Yeah. Yeah, all this tension is psychologically emotional. Sure. I mean, yeah, that household is filled with tension.
Yeah.
Well, because it got polished, maybe so it had to. I don't know.
There's an authenticity for me around the father, too, that there's that stoneness, there's that coldness, there's that rigidness and brittleness. And I'm always fascinated by personalities, so I was waiting for something to happen
mm-hmm.
to this guy. I was waiting for him to crack.
Right.
I was waiting for him
yeah.
to split.
In the fire.
Yeah. In the fire. Yeah. Yeah. And the fire was when Gretchen came back in that night after being out. But that was the crack.
For him. Her going away was the final crack, to me, seemed like the final crack. In because he couldn't
yes.
break through, because he couldn't unbend enough to reconnect with her, he realized he'd driven her away, and that was the final crack to me.
Yeah.
Did you like it better when he didn't have a clear reason for suiciding?
Yeah.
I would say I was satisfied with the original version, but having said that, I know that I like to set up certain situations and leave them hanging so that they are very unresolved, and if there's going to be any real resolution at all, it's going to have to be on the part of the reader. It's not going to come from anyone
else.
It's
like life.
Yeah, so I was fine with it, but Harriet insisted that you've got to have some. So I thought, I tried to do it as unobtrusively as possible. So it's just that little bit. And there's just one other very brief conversation that Gretchen has with her mother,
mm-hmm.
and mother says, I was not your father's first love. I just dropped that line in, made the reference to Cesar's, and I thought, that's enough. There's still some mystery there. Because I don't like tying things up. And of course, the way the novel ends, like, what...
It's a new beginning.
Where's she going?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. For me, that is the reference to the two stars helped me to understand why he had the break in the first place. When
yeah.
he saw her
yeah.
out there with that Indian, as he
yeah.
said.
Yeah, yeah it would
and
make sense.
I was like, maybe that was going to put him over the edge. Just that.
Yeah, no, I must have put in there for that reason.
And yet I also connected with a sense of reason that he was this controlling father, you know, in so many ways, and trying to control his kids, and the heart, as you mentioned, was so cold, and that gradually feeling this containment within himself, enough to have this explosion within that just shut him down. And then the way out of that, you know, sort of space of semi-madness or whatever was going on, one way out for many people through that is to attempt suicide. So even without the two stars, I could see somebody being so imploded
yes.
that they just have to explode
yeah.
and end it
mm.
if they
yeah.
can't get out in a way that's healing.
Yeah. It
seems so stuck. I really felt for the wife, for the mother. She seems so...
Yeah, I wonder what's going to happen to her.
Yeah.
Now that Gretchen's gone.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I went back and reread the novel yesterday and today because I haven't read for a long time, just so I could, you know, familiarize myself with it. And I thought, I really need to write the next story.
Yeah,
there you go.
Yes,
sequel.
Yeah.
Who would you start with? Would you start with the mother?
Well, I really want to know what happens to Gretchen. I really want to know.
Yes.
Gretchen.
Oh, yes, please.
How is she going to end up in James Bay?
I don't think she's ever going to make it to James Bay, but it doesn't matter. But I thought I would like to find out where she goes. I also thought, well, maybe I could write the next one, first person, Sally, years later.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, years later again, maybe do Victoria. But I'd want to know what happens to Gretchen. And so, yeah, it's funny. After reading it today, I thought, I just wanted to sit down and start writing. But I've got to finish this other one.
Yeah.
But maybe I don't. Maybe I need to, I don't know. It's a fascinating process.
Yeah, because she was a very progressive. I mean, you could just see that. I mean, she learned to do the printing and taking off on her own, and you didn't know exactly where. Yeah, she wasn't just going to go and get married and
having kids. My sense is she's never going to. Well, just who knows? But my sense of her now is that she's not going to get married. At least not if I write a sequel. She's not going to. That's not going to happen for her. I can see her. There are all kinds of possibilities. I mean, if she does go to, I mean, I mentioned that she has family in New Brunswick and also in Concord, Massachusetts. And if she goes down that way, there's a good chance, given the time that it is, that she could actually meet Walt Whitman in New York.
Right.
She could actually meet Emerson or Bronson Alcott or Louisa May Alcott or Henry David Thoreau. Because those people are all in Concord.
Yeah, she hit it off with some of those.
And and because she's a writer, she's, you know, I think she'll be a writer. I think that's what she'll end up doing. Either as a journalist, or she might write her own novel, or she'll become a poet or something. So, you know, those possibilities. And but I don't know. I feel like I want to get started on this, but I think, on the other hand, I think I need to think it out a bit more, but then I realize that I don't want to think it out too much.
Mm-hmm. Stay present.
So I'm in this place right now that's just happened this afternoon.
Right.
What do I do?
Yeah.
Well, let me just ask you guys, who would you, if there was a sequel, who would you want to see, Gretchen or Sal, or all of them? Or it'd be interesting to know.
Yeah. I think all of them.
All of them. My sense is that you couldn't do Gretchen without including Sally and Victoria.
Yeah. It'd have to be.
Yeah. She was such a mentor to her siblings that she somehow wanted to stay in touch, even if that was done through letters.
Yes, figured that if I did follow Gretchen, there would have to be letters to everyone, to her mother, to Victoria, Sally, and Patrick. I'm not sure if I'd bring him back in or not. They might have a correspondence or just...
Yeah.
Because he's decided he's staying.
Well, he'll tell you whether he's going
to
come
I know. See, as I'm saying all this stuff, I just...
He'll send a letter to you.
I could see Gretchen writing a novel about Sally, actually.
Yeah.
Sorry?
I could see Gretchen writing a novel about Sally.
A novel about Sally. Or the other way around.
Was Sally, in your mind, ever able to speak a few words, or was she virtually dumb with words? She was so astute with the fiddle and her thoughts and feelings.
I'm trying to remember. I think that when she first was mentioned in the story, I think she actually spoke.
Couldn't remember.
And then right after that, it was just, you know, just normal conversation with her sisters. But immediately after that, she has the dream. And I don't know why that came up, or but this thing, the dream with the heron, and as the dream went on, this thing about her going under the water and the heron, and I thought, oh, maybe, and the way she'd woken up, it would make sense that her voice has been taken by the heron. But it's not a medical problem. It's something that she understands, that she is not to speak.
So was the dream that the heron took her voice? She was under the water.
Yeah.
Was the dream also, because part of that was the parents trying to get the water out of her and bring her back to life. Was that part of the dream, or was that real life in the book?
No, about her being underwater?
And the parents...
trying to get... No, yes. That's the dream.
That's the dream. Okay.
That's the dream. That okay. doesn't happen.
Yeah. I thought she'd had a seizure or something. I went medical on you.
Yeah, no, well, I mean, there's that possibility, because, I mean, I don't state clearly anywhere in the book exactly what the reason is, yeah. but... that's the thing, and which goes back to this idea of leaving things open and hanged. It allows readers to make choices, and there can be two or three different choices for the same event, and they can all be workable. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, it allows you as a writer too yeah. to hear the voices and change the story.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah.
The Heron fit because of the connection with the myths of the I can never pronounce Ojibwe.
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 The Mississauga.
It fit for me with having that piece in the story and the old man, and because in that world that dream would be a very it would be the medical reason she lost her voice. It'd be a good connection. And I also, when you're talking about lack of tension, I was really thinking about, there was definitely tension in that book, a lot of tension for me, and it was around the inner tension of the character herself, Gretchen, with the confines that she was living in, and the part of her that wanted to, her very full-spirited self that was wanting to move outside of that confining, family, you know, her family and the what would have been in store for her as a woman in that time, in that place, and there was always that tension in the characters, what she wanted and what she was grappling with in that stage of her life. So I found that, for me, the thing I loved about that book was how her inner world was revealed. I don't think I've ever read a book where the characters' thoughts about herself, about what was going on in her world, was just so real to me. I felt I always in my own life, I think a lot about what goes on in an individual's inner world, how they think, and I just loved that. I just got to see inside of her, and I was thinking, well, lots of books you get to see inside the person, but I got to see really deep inside of her. And that was just very lovely and unusual.
You know what? That's interesting you said it, because that's the part I like writing. But this is the very thing that other publishers say about other books that they don't want. They don't want all this character, the inner thoughts. And all. They don't want this stuff. Just give me the action. Yeah. But it's that stuff that's what I really like.
That's what really sets you apart.
That's what's captivating.
Yeah.
Staying so present with it. I mean, I was inspired to think, that's how I'd like to write. Just in the present, you know, that's where life happens. It's in the moment, in the present. If I could just write on the keys, and I've tried a little bit of writing, but my fingers can never keep up with my thoughts. And
that's a good sign.
Kind of work. How to stay present, you know. It's such a rich area to mine if one is in that present moment. And I just felt you did that in the book in such a lovely way. It just engaged me. It's neat. I met one of your students. Gloria and I were out at the Broken Paddle. We go there occasionally on Sunday morning for coffee and all their muffin things. This Gloria had gone to the washroom and whatnot. And this gal was sitting just a foot away. And I said, the table's going to be clear in a minute. You can have our table. And she said, there's no hurry. She was at her computer. We just got into talking a few words. And I mentioned about a book, and reading the book group. And immediately I mentioned it was stone in my pocket. I know the bro. You're going to have a great time. I wish I was going, she said. So I just all fired up even more.
It was nice to hear students.
Very positive.
I have to say, too, I had a very strong image of Sally playing her violin at a concert hall in Boston or New York.
Yeah, because I mean, if I do follow her through, that's the fiddle's got to be a really integral part. Mm-hmm. It can't not be. Mm-hmm.
Do you have some personal relationship with the fiddle when you were growing up?
No.
No.
Not when I was growing up.
Or subsequent?
Yeah, my father is a musician, and I studied music from the time I was a little kid, and I was a musician for a long time, and I have degrees in music, and the reason I stopped being a musician, I was a guitarist, and I got this, and so I couldn't play anymore, which is why I went back to school and did all this, and now I'm an English prof. And it's why I started writing, because I couldn't write music anymore the way I wanted to, and that's why I started trying to write. But in terms of music, I did solo acoustic guitar music, and I guess we'd call it the folk genre. It wasn't until I was in my 40s at least that I really started to like Celtic music and fiddle music. And I never liked it before that. And now I thought, boy, if I ever come back, I want to be a fiddle player. it must be glorious to be able to play all those jigs and reels. That's my attachment to the fiddle.
Do you follow Daniel Lapp here?
Yeah, I know Daniel. Oh, I don't know him personally, but yes. Yeah. And I did have a really good friend when I did my first music degree at UVic. One of my good friends, I was a composition major, and he was a performance major, played violin. And when I did my recordings, my stuff after that, he played on the last one. He was such a great fiddle player. He's a software engineer. That's what he does. But the best fiddle player ever. He could, I'd say, here's the tune, and he would put fiddle lines in it that were just heartbreakingly beautiful. I thought, man, you should be doing that. But anyway, the fiddle, yeah.
Who's that?
Sorry?
Who's that, if you're willing to tell
us? His name's Greg Duckett. He lives in Seattle now. He just had a gift. It's just certain people just have do things naturally, wonderfully.
Are any of your albums still available?
They're vinyl, if you can find them out there. A friend just found one in a bin somewhere in Squamish a couple of years ago. Because these are from the 80s, right? And so I don't know. I didn't even have a copy myself. That's another lifetime ago. But just speaking of, the music and the writing, one of the most interesting things I did, I was just telling you about this, Stephen Scobie. If you don't know Stephen Scobie's poetry, he's one of the best poets ever, and one of the best readers of his poetry ever. I've heard many people read their own poetry, and I'm astounded at how badly most poets read their own poetry. But Stephen has this, he just reads it so beautifully. And anyway, he wrote this volume of poetry called The Ballad of Isabel Gunn, who is a real person, and he wrote a series of poems that tells her story. She came over from the Orkneys just up as a man to follow her lover and worked in the Hudson's Bay Company. And anyway, we did this project where I wrote music for it, and on the dulcimer and this other interesting stringed instrument, like a dulcimer, I can't remember what it's called now. And we performed it in several places across Western Canada, from Manitoba here. And so it was Stephen's poetry in my music, and it's that combination of music and writing, which was a lot of fun to do. So that was before I was a writer, I was a musician at the time.
Oh, wonderful.
And that was good fun. But just talking about, people who have natural gifts at what they do, I'm just reminded of that.
Matthew also told me that he and Stephen each had a copy of this, and neither of them could find it.
Yeah, we recorded the last. We started in Winnipeg, I think, and the last performance we did was here in Victoria, and we got someone to record it, and we each had a copy, cassette copy. And then years after that, Stephen we were going to try and get it recorded as an actual album. So Stephen said he couldn't find his copy, and he called me up and said, have you got your copy? I said, sure, I'll go get it. And I couldn't find it. We've both lost our copy, so there is no record. The book is out there. The ballad of Isabel Gunn. And that would be an interesting one if you guys check out. I mean, it's poetry, but it is a story. And it's just, you know, yeah, check it out.
And your first book? What's the name of that?
It's called The Turning of Leaves, but it's not published. So we've tried a couple of times. And I would really like that one to get out there somehow.
Do you ever think about self-publishing or e-publishing?
Yeah, I've thought about self-publishing, but it costs a lot of money, and I don't have a lot of money.
And the e-publishing?
This whole thing is foreign technological territory for me. I'm a real Luddite. I'm a part Luddite partly because I choose to be Luddite, partly because I can't help but be. Computers to me are glorified typewriters. I know how to do email and Google stuff, but the whole, even the thing about blogging, and a lot of people writing their novels, you know, either through blogs or somewhere else, and the publishers will read it and pick it up. And I thought, people said, you should do that. But I don't know, maybe I should think more about that. But I don't know.
You mentioned about the fellow who, the story of Isabel Gunn and the lyrical way that was handled. I'm vision impaired, so most of my reading is either Gloria's kind of reading to me, in this case, or because it wasn't on Talking Book, or I get Talking Books. And some of them are so rich when they're read either by the author or by somebody who's got a real gift for reading. You talked about the importance of having a gift for reading poetry.
Yeah.
And so...
I still do have a copy of Stephen reading the poems, not the music, that he sent me so that I could work on the music. I don't know if Stephen knows I have that, but I still have him. Yeah, maybe I can make some money off his. I just say, hey,
you need to hear that sometime, because most of us here love poetry, and we usually do a round of poetry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember from the Peregrinatio days that you talked about different things that you write longhand with pencil on a pad.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And some things that you write on your computer.
Yeah.
How do you write novels?
At the computer.
Okay.
Poetry, I write, has to be a pencil and a notebook, spiral-bound notebook. The essays for Peregrinatio, when I wrote those with fountain pen. Notebook. They had to be done with fountain pen. Poetry has to be in pencil. Novels are at the keyboard.
Any location?
Well, the great thing about writing in the spiral bound notebook is you can do that anywhere. And I wrote a lot of Peregrinatio and what was at Solstice Cafe. There was a summer. 2 years ago, 2 years ago, I would go there every day in the summer, and just order something to eat and write. And I actually did some revisions of some of my pocket at Solstice Cafe, and so I did the book launch there. Mm. But you know, so in terms of writing the novel, it's. I remember when I got my first laptop, I thought, oh, this is great, then I can at least sit outside or go anywhere and write. Mm-hmm. But I have to do it at home.
Okay.
I can't. I can write the poetry anywhere, the essays anywhere, but the novels I have to do at home. I don't know why. And I cannot write poetry on the computer. And I've tried writing novels with, won't work with a pencil, a little better with a fountain pen. Mm-hmm. That's odd. I don't know why that is.
So you sit down, when you're writing a novel, you sit down and say to yourself, I'm now going to write the novel, and I'm sitting here, and I'm going to do this.
Yeah. And, you know, the really odd thing is, and it's always been this way, and I don't know why, but I resist sitting down to write. And when I have lots of time off, I'm thinking, great, I have all this time off, I can write, this is what I want to do, and I will resist, I'll find anything to do except sit down and write.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, what's this about? This is what I want to do. Why do I not want to do it? Right now I've got some time off, and I think, great, I'll finish the novel, and I'll go for a few days, and some days I have to really force myself to sit down and turn on the computer and open up the file. But when I do that, every time I force myself to do it, something always comes.
Yeah.
And I wonder about all those times when I refuse to do it, what I'm missing. Because, you know, what I'll write in one day, if, how do I put this? The days that I don't write, whatever I would have written on those days will never come.
Yeah.
It will never come. Something different will come, but what I missed those days will never come. And I'm really, you know, clear about this. The analogy I use is, if you want to go somewhere on the train, like you really want to travel somewhere on the train, that guy, I'm already go, but you got to go to the train station because it's not coming by your house.
Yeah.
And so I have to force myself to go to the train station. Every time I do, I'm glad I went. But the days you don't go, you're not going to have, you're going to miss that trip. You can't have that same trip the next day. And so I often think about that, about the stories or parts of stories that don't get written because I wouldn't sit down and be there for when be at the station for when the train came. So
I would imagine, though, that on the days that you resist and you go off and do other things, that's also gathering information about life for which you can write later.
Yeah, I like to think so.
You know what it's like to resist.
Yeah, I should.
Have you ever audio recorded anything?
No, you know, that's interesting. I know a lot of people do that, and I can't do that. I can't speak the story. I have to write it.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And I really like the idea of walking off the tape recorder and wherever you are, just stop, and just pull up the tape recorder and, recite the next few lines of the novel. And thought, what a great way to, because you can do it anywhere, and I can't do that.
And nowadays with that Dragon Dictate and the recorder, if it's keyed in properly, it can put it straight from the recorder.
Yeah,
so it's
just
computer out of it.
You know. Yeah, I know.
But if you're not into it, it's not.
No,
it's a horrible process.
And I, just thinking about that and the new technology, I know that if I ever decided to do something different about the way I write, it wouldn't be to go to the ebook or to that thing. It would be to get an old ribbon typewriter. That's what I would do. And it's a very romanticized thing. Do you notice that in any movie you see, even movies that are set in the present, the last few years, if there's a writer, it's always got a typewriter. It's always a typewriter. It's amazing. I think I've seen one movie where the guy was actually writing at a computer. Yeah. Because it's this romanticized thing about the typewriter.
And the paper, going in the wastebasket.
Yeah. But it's the sound of the keys, the punching, slapping on the paper, and the bell when it rings, and the rolling, and there's a whole, it's romantic. Yeah, it's a very tactile thing. That's what I even miss about, not that I can't play the guitar anymore, I can still play the piano, but what I miss, speaking of things tactile, the guitar is, you know, the vibration of the strings on your fingers, the vibration of the guitar mm-hmm. body against your body. You don't get that with a piano. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, the vibration's happening somewhere inside the thing, but it's not to you.
But you're playing dulcimer by the end of it.
A little bit. I can still work that, but it's not as...
Mm-hmm. Not as appealing.
Well, it doesn't have the scope.
Yeah. Your muse is kinesthetic.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, it's funny because when I, you know, I think about resisting sitting down to write. When I was playing the guitar, that was never a problem. I would play for hours every day. It was just not. There's no resistance whatsoever there. But with the writing, there is. Mm. Don't know. And maybe it is that it's because it's not kinesthetic. Maybe that's what it is. That it's too cerebral.
Yeah, when you described that element that you're in now with your students where you're having to go over everything, I can see how that takes away from that joy of just being in the moment with the writing.
Yeah.
So the juxtaposition between those two, maybe when you retire from teaching, that you'll be able to let that go more. And just
well,
you need that skill to keep on, don't you?
I'll be able to afford to retire in about 15 or 20 years. So. But no, it is true. I find that, there's just, I don't like analyzing. I like talking about it. Oh, that's another whole issue about teaching literature. I would like to do it in a different way.
Have you had any opportunities to get your students into using that lovely in the present moment form of writing themselves?
Yeah, well, I get them to do free writes.
Right.
I don't know if you do that. Where it's an exercise where you just, I give them one line or an idea topic, and the point is to say, okay, once I'll tell you the idea is what it is, and once I tell you to start writing, you start writing, you do not stop your pen from moving across the page. You do not stop at all. You don't worry about punctuation, spelling.
Mm-hmm.
You don't go back and cross anything out.
Right.
If you can't think of something to say, you just write, I can't think of what to say, and you keep writing that until you can think of what to say. The thing is, do not stop the pen from moving across the page.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I'll tell you when to start. I'm not going to tell you when I'm going to tell you to stop so that you don't know. You can't think 5 minutes or 10 minutes. I might make you write for the whole class. Might be 5 minutes. You don't know, so you just write. So I get them to do that.
They're pretty exciting.
And for some of them, they come up with stuff. The point of doing that is that you will come up with ideas that you would not come up with any other way.
Mm.
That if you just sat down to think about something, you would not come up with ideas. And again, maybe it's that kinesthetic thing again.
Mm.
And so that gets back to the way I write, not knowing where I'm going to go. It's a kind of free write. It's a little more controlled.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't sit down and think about what I'm going to do first.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that same kind of thing.
Yeah.
If it's been a while since you last wrote and you're in the midst of something, do you kind of read back and familiarize?
Yeah, I have to.
Yeah.
And that's happened with the novel I'm working on now. I hadn't said it. This is the thing. During the teaching term, I sometimes don't write, and then I get some time off and I go back. And then so I reread what it's. So, in order to know where I am, how I got here,
right.
Just so that when I move forward, I know where I'm moving forward from.
Yeah.
That's often interesting to do.
Yeah. And I know some authors like would create in really complex situations. I studied anthropology, and I know that. Some people have like a lot of complex interrelationships and families and so on. They'll do kinship diagrams
and
all that kind of stuff. Do you ever do that?
No, never. It's too much planning.
Yeah.
It's for me, and it works well for someone obviously,
mm-hmm.
but not for me.
Yeah.
I that paralyzes me. I find if I try to do that, I can't write lyrically because then I'm. I think I gotta get this in. And it's just, it's not as exciting for me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I want to have fun doing this. I want to enjoy the process.
Yeah.
Well, it seemed to me that you're setting up boundaries and you have to stay within those boundaries.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm not a big fan of boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a far too general statement, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of writing.
I think it was Julia Cameron, was it, that brought up the thing about just writing, just keeping writing,
yeah,
every morning, do
the artist's way.
Half an hour, artist's
mm-hmm.
way.
Yeah.
And I was drawn to that book because I do fine arts and don't do it currently, but I was thinking, how can I do this in the arts? And I'm thinking, if I started over again and went back into arts, which I can't do now, I would have a lot of paper out, a lot of paint, and I'd just go sheet after sheet
yeah.
and try and cut out this thing. What am I trying to paint? Or what image am I trying to create? Just go with color. Sense and form, just
yeah.
I like the idea of your writing. That's
well, it's the spontaneity, which
yes,
I think is
yeah,
really important. And there's
excitement.
There's this French philosopher in the 60s, I think his name is Gaston Bachelard, and he wrote several books on the psychology of fire and the poetics of space.
Mm.
And in the introduction to one of his books. It was about the products of space, and I was reading it because the novel I was working on. Okay, I'm going off on a tangent here, so remember where I was, because I'm going to forget.
Okay.
The tangent I'm going to go off on. I was working on writing a novel, and here's the danger of not knowing where you're going to go. I'm 80 pages into this novel, and it's about this young guy, and he's basically telling. He's looking back. On his life, telling the story of his life. It's 80 pages, and he's remembering this moment when he was 14 or something. And he meets this girl, this young girl, and he's really attracted to her. And he decides that he wants to kiss her at some point. And he knows that he wants it to be spontaneous. And so he plans it for weeks. I don't have a spontaneous kiss. So they're in a bookstore one day, and looking for, and he's standing beside him, and he goes, okay, this is the moment. So he reaches over, he puts his hand behind her back, and just as he does that and goes in for the kiss, she's reaching up for a book. So when he kisses her, her arm is up there, and it's just this really awkward kiss, but they kiss anyway, and then when they finish the kiss, you know, he draws back and he looks at her, and he looks into her eyes, and he can see all these landscapes as if he's looking through a window into her eyes. And I'm writing, I'm 80 pages into the book, I know who this guy is, I think. And as I'm writing, but you know, he looks into her eyes, and then this sentence comes, he says, it was at that moment that I decided that I would be an architect. I thought, it's a little late for that information. And I thought, let's just strike that out and write something else. No, that's not how it works. So I had to go and do all this research on architecture because I knew nothing about architecture. And that's why I ended up reading The Poetics of Space. I remember where I was. So what this guy said, he was talking about what he called the phenomenological moment, which is a wonderfully obtuse term, but what it is that moment, and it can happen for a writer or a reader. And if it's for the writer, it's that moment when an image comes to you. And you don't know where it comes from, but it just comes, it's spontaneous, and you write it down. And you write it down as quickly as you can, because that particular moment, what he calls a phenomenological moment, is before the analytical mind kicks in and starts looking at this image and says, well, is it good? How can I change it? It's like just before that happens, and it's such a brief moment, get it down and let it be.
Yeah.
It's a kind of an aha moment. And it's the aha kind of aha moment that a reader will have. You know, when you're reading something, and you come across a passage and you just go, oh, wow.
Yeah.
And just before you start to analyze it or think why it's good, there's that brief moment where spontaneous just happens And that's the magic moment. And so what you're talking about, just having all the pages, that's what you're looking for. That's, you're trying to be in that moment and try to stretch that little moment out as long as you can, or keep repeating it.
Give it a space for it to show up.
Maybe, you know, the space that it ends up, when it shows up in such a tiny space because that's all the space you allowed. So maybe if the practice is to create this large space that when it does come, it has space to move around and stay for a while before the analytical part comes in. And I really think the creative process for me is about those moments. And it's back to why I write the way I do, is because I don't want to try to... I don't want to say, okay, if you're going to come, here's the door you have to walk through. I don't want to do that. It's a bunch of doors, whatever door you want to come through, that's fine with me. And, yeah.
When you're in that moment, that special moment, you have a sense of losing all sense of time. You're just so present at the moment that the kind of clocks stop and you're just so present that you could be there a minute, 10 minutes.
Yeah, now. That happens, but yeah, and of course I'm not aware of it till after that time.
Afterwards,
over.
Yeah.
Because if you're aware of it at the time, you wouldn't be there,
yeah.
Obviously.
You're right over it, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's,
I
was just thinking of that. That's why I was thinking one of those moments must have come through in your book, because it affected Christine and I, because we were talking after I read the book, and I said, yeah, there were some really great lines in that book, and I even wrote some of them down, and Christine said, oh, darn, there was one I really wanted to write down, and I said, well, what I wrote down was curiosity turns fear into life. And she said, that's it! That's the one I wanted to write down!
Yeah.
So
I wrote that one down, too.
Did you?
That's what I wrote down. Curiosity turns fear into life.
Yes, and you wrote it, yeah.
That's amazing. Page 20.
Wow.
Right,
if I was going through the book, would that noise that remained with me, that wouldn't have been one of them.
Yeah.
Would not have been?
No, curiosity turns fear into life. I don't, yeah. It's not bad.
Very wise characters.
Yeah. Boy, who wrote that?
Well, look at this. This is...
These notes were made with sticky notes, really.
Right. Oh.
Did you miss that
one? Can you share that with us?
Was the one, years we treasure, where is it here? There are years we treasure and years we simply survive, and all those years together make us who we are.
Yeah.
And the others, I didn't put any notes on them. I'd have to read.
Okay.
But when I was reading, Douglas said, okay, put a sticky there.
You too, you were grabbing them.
I really liked the paragraph from a few sentences from the picnic. And then I took the very first sip of wine in my life. The dark red color did not suggest the bitter taste of it, and yet it was a stimulating kind of bitter, a grown-up kind of bitterness. Okay. This, I thought, is what Eve must have felt like when she first bit into the apple.
Yeah.
A sudden understanding, a knowing for the first time that life was not perfect, but that it was now hers to live. The joy and the pain would be hers by choice, and that would make all the difference.
Yeah,
yeah,
that's
yes.
A beautiful.
Yeah.
Had you forgotten that one, too?
No, because I just read the novel today.
That's
again. And it's fascinating, when I hear someone else read it, it sounds so much more profound than when I read it than when I wrote it. And how do I say this? When you read that, I think, wow, I wrote that? And I often have those moments when I go back and think, wow, because I think I could never think of something like that again. It just happened. I mean, those sentences just came one from the other, and I had no idea one from the first sentence that it would get to that last sentence in that way. Yeah. And so I am.
I think you have an amazing relationship with your muse. You're giving your muse.
I guess I do. I feel. I feel. This may odd to say this, but I feel really blessed to have been able to write something like that. And I don't know where it comes from. I feel blessed, and I feel glad that I can do it. I don't mean that to sound, you know, egotistical. That's not what I mean. And I think, it's that kind of stuff that just gets me out of bed each morning, knowing that there's the possibility of doing that again.
Well, we're awfully glad that you can.
Yeah. I want to read this one thing that I wrote down, that same phrase, but I realized that if I wrote down everything that kind of appealed to me that way, I wouldn't read the book. I stopped doing it, but this is really a simple thing about passage of time, but I just loved it. June collapsed into July as if it were out of breath. And each day of July took a deep breath of sun and measured it out into night, as if it were practicing to dive into the water and swim across the lake to the far shore, a shore that was too far away to see from this side. And that's how I felt, too. Or maybe I was just treading water far out into the middle of the lake, far from any shore, waiting for someone to come and pull me into a boat and row me back to the safety of land once again.
Man, I gotta get someone to read this book to me. it occurs to me how much more powerful the spoken voice is than just the written page. Mm-hmm.
Pleasantly surprised at hearing your own spoken voice reading page or two and then playing it back to yourself. It's a good quality player, and because you know you're so much into and behind and in your book that and you speak so eloquently that I have a hunch that would come up back very nicely, but also nicely being read by somebody else. Yeah. And so I wished I'd had to take the player on when Gloria's reading it to me, because I'd like to heard it again.
Yeah.
But it was so different, because when I was reading it to Douglas, must have read about 90% of the book. It was just the sharing, and then I went home and finished it. I just had about 30 more pages to read, and it just wasn't the same.
You know, it's really funny that we're talking about this, because I only finished this book this morning, and I'm kind of starting a new relationship with a woman from choir. And I've got this friend, this 95-year-old woman I visited many times in Greece, and she's now in a nursing home, probably pretty close to death. Anyway, I spoke with her on the phone, and I introduced Karen and Jean, these two friends of mine. And I went to bed reading this book last night and fell asleep reading it. Woke up this morning and had some time, so I was finishing reading the book. And I get this email from a friend, Karen, and I write to her that I'm reading this book, and I said, you know, if money were unlimited, what I'd want to do right now is get on a plane, take her, and sit at Jan's bedside and read her this book. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Best gift that I can think of, actually, for Jan. And Jan's this poet. With all her life. There's something so lyrical and musical and so visual, so evocative about this book.
So real. Yeah.
in that part that you were reading there, I spent some of my childhood in that area and that you are talking about here.
Oh, really?
Swamps and yeah. Water and the clear yeah. Water. And I spent most of my summers when I was there in the water. And so the June collapsing into the July, and it's dripping with water, and it's dripping with the refreshment of water and the heat and the flow. Yeah, I'm right there and I'm feeling it. I'm physically feeling it all around me as you're reading that. It's just, and that happened a lot for me in this book, that I was right there and I could feel it. I could feel it inside and I could feel it in my body. It was a real gift.
Well, the interior landscape and the exterior mm-hmm. landscape are so
yes.
lyrically meshed, mm-hmm. and both are beautifully described. Mm-hmm. And that it binds. It's such a, each adds to the other.
Precious book.
Mm-hmm. So much of life seems to be about trying to get that balance between the inner and the outer, mm-hmm. and get the weaving, the tapestry mm-hmm. right. And for many of them, it takes a lifetime. It seems to take me longer than a lifetime. But I just thought, there's Gretchen. She's going up, and she's, between what she's learned and her teacher. Nobody mentioned the wonderful teacher she had, her mentor. Mm-hmm. But she's going out there, and this interweaving has taken place for her so well. I get the feeling. She'll have her struggles and her battles, but she's going out really a well-balanced young woman through this. And the sisters are coming along in the same way because she's been mentoring them. The mother hasn't been able to do so much of that, unfortunately. It's a lot about that interweaving, that side is delightful.
Yeah. I wish I had a quarter of her insight at that age.
Yes, me too. Oh, yes.
I wish I had a quarter of her insight at age 30.
But that's the other gift of your writing. You have that's in you now. You're yes. able to portray it, and then others read it. And that's why I wish some of the CBC radio things would get one a book like yours in there and talk about it and get it because it deserves to be. It's so rich and it's such a momentum, such an encouragement to handle and hang in with those opposites that can be so challenging at times, but to see how the growth is happening, that book speaks so much to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've already passed it on to another book group. Maybe what we need to do as a book group is propose it for Keanu Reeves next year.
Yeah. Hey, okay.
That's a good idea.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. We can do that.
Yeah. I've often wondered about that. Canada Reads.
What does it take to do that?
I don't know how they get those. Mm-hmm. I always thought there's got to be someone who's got pull somehow.
Mm-hmm. And Gio Meshi is another one. Doesn't he do a big thing around books once a year?
That's it. We're small, but we can be loud.
Yeah. Right, yeah. That's right. And he talked about coming to Victoria one of these days.
Anyways,
we can give him a poem, too.
Yeah. Yes, the poem's ready to pass on.
So I have to write the next
one. Put it on the map.
Yeah, you write a little bit here.
And then fold it over.
So we can Google and find out what the process is around.
I think they take nominations and they work with that.
All right. So we'll all send independently. Right?
Yes.
And after each other.
And as a group. Mm-hmm. And if you have another name.
Yeah.
Yeah. Aya.
Well, we can start a movement by passing the book amongst book groups. And when we pass along the idea of recommending it to Canada Reads.
Yes.
And see what happens.
That's one of the reasons I bought this book, because I've talked to so many of my friends about it, so I thought, let one read it, then pass it on.
Mm-hmm. I've got a whole list of people waiting to borrow it.
Mm-hmm. We'll have to come out in the hardcover. We're going to lend it out all up. Thank you. And our next book is Law's Orchestra Saves the World. Finished it.
What page was that thing about curiosity?
Put a sticky on it.
Yeah.
Now, copies should be bought from you.
Yeah, I have some. I brought some with me. I have some more at home.
I'd like to have another one. I'm giving it as a gift.
Sure.
I like to send favorite Canadian books to two sisters in the U.S. So I'm very selective.
Yeah, too.
It sounds like I think with me.
If you can afford to.
Yeah. No, I've got like a dozen at home. I thought maybe it would be one or two just in case. Well, I've only got two left.
Well, what a great gift to family member, you know. Gee.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you. Okay. And you guys know Andy is just graduating from university.
Actually, have Matthew sign one of these books and then give the one that John's got to hand.
I want to. Can you sign them? That'd be grand. I'm going to give you a pen.
How much are they again? I haven't seen the price for
$20.
$20?
So, are you going to make it to someone or just sign it?
One is for Andy, and the other one you can just leave open. Right. Andy, A-N-D-Y.
Yeah.
He'll love it. Okay.
Sure.
Do you have another one to sell?
I've got one more.
I'd like to get the big one. It's fine.
Aww. Read it.
I'm being stubborn. Let me see if I can.
Was I signing one of these, both of these?
Both, please.
So one's
for Andy. The other one is just with the no.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just
nobody.
Thank you. I got it.
It's okay, because I've bought one, so he can buy the other one. I don't want.
Oh, okay, so you want one.
Okay, so
sorry.
Glory gave you one that she'd bought separately.
Yeah.
Hadn't got from you. She got it as an extra.
Okay.
No, sorry.
This is the one I bought from
you. All right.
This is not going to be easy for you.
So this one's
one I wrote it last year, so if you could sign it.
All right, so...
Can you read? No?
Do you want me to...
It sounds like... Oh, Costello, who's on first base. Yeah.
Thank you.
Who's making things on?
Thank you so much.
Mine. Appreciate it. So did I... So you got...
Yes. Okay, so that
Douglas took mine, so you, so this you could is, sign that
okay,
one.
So this one.
You mean you've given Douglas all, the one with all the stickies on it?
No, that's a library one. We better not get that one signed back.
Take them all.
It's just delightful that you could
thank
come.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah.
It's been very lovely.
Thank you.
You're
so
out of
much.
You're out of copies now, is that right?
I've got some at home.
Right.
Yeah,
okay.
Did you want
to? Yeah, I want to.
Did you want one of mine?
Well, I can.
One of okay. Okay.
Wait, contact. We'll figure it out.
Okay, because if you need one right away, I've
no,
got
no.
No. Curiosity turns fear into life, page 70.
Amazing. Like, what, 3 or 4 different people picked that passage? That's amazing.
Sold out again. Great.
this is an honor for me to just have you people read my book, and I'm glad you liked it, and thank you for all the kind things. Mm-hmm. So
I don't think they were kind. I think they were honest and truthful.
No,
absolutely.
Yeah, that did such a, for me, a sense of excitement to have a real author here. You know, I've read so many books, but I've never risen to such dizzy heights to have a real author here. Wow, this is something totally different, you know. Mm-hmm. Talk about being present. Just great.
I don't know what it was quite, but just, you know, this brought me to tears like 4 or 5 times just this morning reading the last 25-30 pages. Even what it was, just really touched by how, you know, her character unfolds and what you tell, what you share about the how she's affected by Walt Whitman's words. So I know that's been a big influence for you.
Yeah. Yeah, I had to work Walt in her. There's this serendipity that, you know, he happens to publish his first book right when this is out. Oh, but this is perfect. Just.
Anything about the killdeer? Like, why does that keep coming up?
I just have really interesting memories that the shingle bar, which is it separates the marsh from the lake. Yeah. That first little chapter is about how it's all formed, but all these, you know, flat gray stones, and the killdeer lay their eggs in the stones and they camouflage, and so you can end up stepping on them. And they're just, when you see one, when you find one, it's such an amazing moment. And I just, I got to wherever I was, and it occurred to me, I thought, killed your egg. So,
it's one of my favorite birds, and the place I live at, Christie Point, Bure Isle here, sticks out into the Portage Inlet, and I've been there nearly 20 years, and so for the first 10 years I was there, I heard these killdeer, saw them and heard them, and of course they feed in the shores there around the point, and it was so lovely. And at night time they'd be sending their cry out, even in the darkness and the dusk, I'd hear them go around, and this haunting cry, such a lovely cry. And then they changed the beachfront, and we all fought in many spots. They said, don't change, don't put any stones. While they did, there wasn't a killdeer.
Wow.
It just ruined the whole foreshore. I really miss that sound. It's just
I hate when favorite places change.
Yeah. You've obviously experienced that with the area you talked about.
Yeah. Well, sorry, I grew up there in the house I grew up in is my father built. And they were there for 40 years, so I left. So he built it in 52, I guess. I left in 74. And then one of the reasons I left is the whole area is changing too much for me. And I remember I went back somewhere in the mid-90s, and I knew my parents were moving, and I didn't know when I was going to get back to the marsh, and I was sitting on the shingle bar just trying to, you know, soak it all in to keep a part of it. And I just looked down and I saw this little stone. Mm-hmm. So this little stone is from the shingle bar. Mm-hmm. So I just keep it. Mm-hmm. But I have been back since. So, but they've preserved the area. The marsh has been preserved. But there are boardwalks through it and houses around it. And I thought, I always thought it was, I felt an ownership of it. Because when I was a kid, we played out there. It's 100 acres. There's the marsh and all this woodland. And you know, often I would be the only kid out there. Or there might be two or three of us in this, all this area. And just, it was, so it's like, you feel an ownership for those places when you're young. And so I really resented when they built the subdivision around the area. Even that, I resented, because then you could see houses from various points in the marsh. Then when I went back and they built the boardwalk, and all these people walking through the boardwalk, and I'm thinking, how dare you people come here? This is my place. Just, I guess they get to enjoy it in their own way.
And how many birds that you heard and loved have probably had to move on for their wilderness areas to have their nests, because it's just too many people.
Well, yeah, there's still a lot of birds.
And
there are black-crowned herons there still. But yeah, I feel really fortunate to have grown up in that place.
How's it for you being out here on the West Coast here and nature and life around you? Does that help to fill you up a little bit, even though you don't have that?
You know, it's odd, because I first came out here in 74, and then I was in Calgary for a couple of years doing a music degree, and then I went back east for 5 years to do my literature degrees, and then came back again. So I've been in Victoria for half my life, at least, and it's still doesn't feel like home. When I go back to Port Credit, you know, walk the river, go to the marsh, it's home. But I don't know if I could move back there. It's an odd kind of pull and separation that I feel. But there's I miss the seasons. I miss the colors in the autumn. The leaves are turning yellow. Yon red one, brown, but back there.
Brilliant red.
But, so, you know, as I say, part of the reason I set all my novels there is it's a way to preserve the place for me.
Yeah.
And I write it as I remember it.
You must relive it, too, as you write it.
Yeah.
You're right there.
Yeah. And, but we all have those places, I think.
We have a poem, don't we?
Yeah, we have a poem. Of course, I get to read it.
Yeah, sure.
Unless there are any volunteers.
Let's see here. Okay. Clear, still, from the warm heart, rippled into the night. Skimming across the water, spider light with joy, spinning into infinity, a spiral galaxy unfolding behind that fifth star, that is four times removed from whom I was, and many times removed from whom I think I am becoming. For who I am and becoming is curiosity. What is that mysterious yearning to know? The other way. What is that mysterious yearning to know? For who I am and becoming is curiosity. And many times removed for who I think I am becoming, that is four times removed for who I was. A spiral galaxy unfolding behind that fifth star, spinning into infinity, spider light with joy, skimming across the water, rippled into the night, clean still from the warm heart.
Wow.
Wow, it really works that way.
Yeah. So often in reverse.
Well, that's amazing. They're like, oh, yeah, yeah. In reverse, it sounds like.
Yeah.
That's
so often.
Amazing.
Yeah.
We're the backward palm group. Yeah.
Wow, that's great. Yeah.
We're all set to publish our poems once and do pictorial things. And we've been so excited about them, but we never quite got the time to put it together.
Well, I've still got 3 or 4 years of.
Yeah.
Accumulation of them.
Wow. Yeah, there could be a little book in itself.
Mm-hmm. Have you any books that relate to the way you wrote that you enjoy occasionally reading yourself that you'd care to share?
Yeah, actually, the writer that I think writes, well, which way I put this, writes most like I did. Or the writer I write most like, who's grammatically tortured, is Jane Urquhart.
Jane Urquhart?
Yeah.
Oh, I came across her.
She's a wonderfully lyrical writer. Yeah. So anything by her. The best ones, well, there's one called The Whirlpool.
Yeah.
Which is set in Niagara Falls in the 1880s. It's a great novel. It's one called Away, which follows three generations of people in southern Ontario. Jane Urquhart's from southern Ontario as well. So, and Map of Glass. Oh, there's a really interesting one she wrote called Changing Heaven. And it's about a woman, it's set in the 1960s, a woman. She comes from Toronto, who loves the book Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte. And she loves the book because she loves the weather in it.
Yeah.
Anyway, she goes to Yorkshire to visit Haworth, the parsonage where the Brontes grew up. And she ends up meeting the ghost of Emily Bronte. Is a character in the book. And it's a fascinating story.
Wow. And that's Whirlpool.
No, that one's called Changing Heaven.
Changing Heaven.
And it's one of the books I used for my PhD. I wrote on it. And there was something about, I remember there was something in the book I wanted to know about, and I couldn't find in my research anyway, so I thought, I'll just call Jane Urquhart.
Okay.
And I looked in the phone book, and she was listed.
Wow.
And so she lived somewhere near Waterloo. So I phoned up, and she answers the phone.
Great.
I says, this is Jane Urquhart, yes. So I say, well, you don't know me, but this is who I am. This is what I'm doing. And I just had this question about this. So yeah, I remember that part, and I've got the information. Can you just hold on a bit? I'll just go get it. It's in the library. She comes and tells me all the stuff I need to know. We talk for a while. And it was great. And yeah, she's a wonderful person over the phone. And I met her once. She came for a book signing here.
Wow.
This is years and years ago. And then I remember we corresponded for a bit, and I said, you know, if I ever get a novel published, I'll send you a copy.
And did you?
Well, I did, and I didn't know where her address was anymore, so I sent it through the publisher, her publisher. I don't know if she ever got it, because I never heard back from her. But I thought, come on, Jane, read this and love it. and tell everybody about it. Make me famous. But she didn't. Anyway, Jane Urquhart. I really like her stuff. And, you know, my favorite writer now, for the last few years, J.D. Salinger. J.D. Salinger. But, you know, he wrote a few books.
Did he die or
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there are, you know, rumors of boxes of manuscripts that he has that he refused to publish. And
right.
I often wonder, like, on one hand, I thought, wouldn't it be great if those could be published and more J.D. Salinger to read? But I thought, if he didn't want them published, they shouldn't be published. Mm-hmm. You know, it shouldn't be put out there. But I just love his way of creating characters. Boy.
Yeah.
My sister and her husband live in Cornish Flat, New Hampshire, which is where J.D. Salinger, I've been past his farm, actually.
Wow.
and my brother-in-law was a journalist for a good many years, and he did try to interview J.D. Salinger, and of course, it didn't happen.
Yeah.
But he'd see him in the village, you know. he was very, very, he wasn't as reclusive with the villagers as he was with other people, but the villagers protected his.
Yeah, that's what I heard. They were very protective of him.
Yeah.
Well, he was lucky for him.
Yeah. They wouldn't tell outsiders where he lived.
Yeah.
I'll have to ask him if he's heard anything about unpublished boxes of books.
Yeah, I just remember when we died, there were a couple of references to that. But it's that same kind of thing, like as a reader, you think, oh, I love to have the stuff, but you'd also like to honor the writer. As well.
There's a bit of that with the honoring of the king's speech. The person waited 20 years getting permission or the okay before he put that movie together. He wanted to do it 20 years ago, I think. Whatever his name was, he got some award. Oscars,
and the Queen Mother said, no, not while I'm alive.
That's right, yeah. He waited those 20 years.
Not while he was alive?
While she was alive.
Yeah. There are lots of interesting stories like that. It reminds me also of Sylvia Plath, the poet. She committed suicide when she was 30, and she was married to Ted Hughes, and they were separated at the time. But she kept a journal, apparently right up until a few days before she committed suicide. And the journals that were published stop about at least 6 months before she committed suicide. And Ted Hughes had the journals that she had written right up until the end. And he destroyed them. Mm-hmm. And I thought, yeah. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, you know, I'd love to, you know, what was she, what, you know, what was going through her mind as she got close to that time? Mm-hmm. You just love to know, just to try to experience it somehow. You know, obviously at a distance, but.
Ted Hughes committed suicide as well, did he not?
I don't think so. I know he died, but was it suicide?
Yeah, I thought he did, and I thought
I don't.
At the time thinking such a long time after, I know they weren't in a relationship anymore, but
I might be mistaken. I don't know for sure, I just remember.
He was speaking about the King's speech. I just saw an interview with Harvey Weinstein, who produced the movie, and he lives in New York, and he said he read it quite a few years ago, and was just really, really, and captured by the story. And he wanted to make the movie. Of course, he had his priorities, but he finally got it made. When he read it, someone had just passed him the manuscript, and but of course he said he reads everything he can get his hands on.
Yeah.
So, and he just got taken by it and said, "I'm going to make that one." So.
He was the one that made the agreement with the Queen Mother not to do it for 20 years, wasn't it?
I think it was the screenwriter.
Oh, the one who wrote the
book. Yeah, the screenwriter, right?
Because apparently that 20 years was crucial, because at the end of that 20 years, apparently they got a hold of a whole lot of letters that had been written that weren't available, and they added quite a bit to the making of the movie or something.
For purely selfish reasons, I hope you do have a sequel.
Yeah, me too.
Well, you know, it's funny, after reading the book again today, and then just after this, I'm thinking, yeah, I really have to do that. Maybe I'll just put this other one aside for the moment and just go with this before I start thinking too much about it.
I hope it includes all the characters. There's a richness of having everybody involved. Yeah.
I'm sure they'll get involved.
No, it would just be nice to come back to that style of writing. Pick up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well,
thanks for arranging the
power.
Thank you. And thank you, everyone.
When's that? Do you have a date?
20 seconds less. 2 hours.
So is that just like an I something?
It's an iPhone.
Really?